This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. You'd think Sherlette Ammons would want a little privacy. The writer and musician grew up just outside Mount Olive, North Carolina, in a rural country home with her mom, twin sisters, aunts, uncles, and dozens of cousins. I mean, there were a lot of people around. And personal space was just a fantasy for young Sherlette. But when she left home to attend college at North Carolina State University, she found that writing offered her a space for quiet self-reflection. She began to scribble her most intimate thoughts about family, race, gender, and sexuality. Scribbled them down on paper, and then, well, she could have kept them to herself, but she also found liberation in sharing her words with others. Her first collection of poetry was published in 2002 in Stumphole Anthology of Backwoods Blood. Sherlette paid homage to her Southern roots and the oral tradition of storytelling. In 2008, another collection of poems called Matching Skin offered readers fearless honesty about Sherlette's experience as a black gay woman in the American South. Sherlette Ammons pursues the truth in her music as well. She's a self-taught bass player and the vocalist for Mosadi Music, a hip-hop band based in the Triangle. Most recent musical effort is And Lovers Like, a collaboration with Chapel Hill blues rockers The Dynamite Brothers. Sherlette Ammons is my guest on the program today, here to talk about her ever-growing body of creative work and why she will always call North Carolina home. Sherlette Ammons, welcome back to this Day of Things.
Thanks so much, Frank. Good to see you again.
Talk about your home growing up outside Mount Olive, North Carolina, and your extended family. How many people under that roof?
Boy, at any given time, I would imagine upwards of 20 folks.
Wow.
Yeah. So it included my mom, and my mom has 13 brothers and sisters. Well, 13 in all, including her. And everybody wasn't there, but the majority of folks was there. And then we had all my cousins lived in the same house. For all intents and purposes, it was, you know, a fairly run down house. But, you know, I think because there were so many people there, we kind of focused more on the wealth of just being together as opposed to what we didn't have.
Real so country much. Living, I mean, didn't have, like, running water, right?
Absolutely. Until I was 12, no running water, no indoors bathroom. Had a big wood pile in the back, a cat house, a smokehouse, and an outhouse. So
you're a real estate magnet, really.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways. Yeah, that's pretty good. Were you aware? I mean, you talked about this kind of this business of social capital. You knew you had each other, a kind of wealth in that. I mean, were you aware of what you didn't have?
I think I only became aware of it when I went to school, because a lot of the families that lived around us, we lived Route 1, Box 80. We lived on a routed road, I guess it would be called. But a lot of our cousins, extended cousins who we didn't live with, lived in similar situations. And extended family members lived in similar situations, like on the same highway. Hmm. But the houses in between that were the larger farmers, the white folks, lived obviously better than we did in terms of access and just physical wealth, I guess.
When did that become obvious to you?
I think it became most obvious, like I said, when we started going to school. And one time we had this friend come stay over, and she was really adamant about going home. Like, she didn't want to stay. And we were like, me and my twin were like, what's wrong? And it was literally about she was really uncomfortable with how we lived. And it was kind of a heartbreaker, you know. But it also was an eye-opener, and we were like, wow, I guess the way we lived is a bit exclusive, for lack of a better word.
And your mother stayed home. She took care of.
Right. My mom was responsible, was kind of like the homemaker, my mom and my grandma, for raising all of us, me, my sister, and all my cousins. And my aunts went out to work. Most of them worked in the plants, you know, and beyond the tobacco field, they either worked at the turkey plant or Mount Olive Pickles. And then all my uncles pretty much worked in the fields as hirelings, kind of tobacco fields mainly.
You have a twin sister. Was that a special relationship? Could you feel almost alone with your twin, in a sense, in that big environment?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Me and twin were always and still are like two peas in a pod. I mean, And growing up, we just had a really intimate dependency on each other in terms of ways to escape in an environment where people are always around. Just a shared creativity, you know, almost like one person in many ways. That was always, and we're always supportive and protective of each other. Mm. Kind of like a shield against the world before we even knew that we needed it.
I was going to ask you that. When did you feel you needed it? When did you have a sense that you wanted some more personal space? You needed to escape this?
Honestly, didn't feel it till later. There were moments along, you know, high school, you know, when you're tracked to be a particular way, and Twin and myself were always two of three black kids that were quote unquote tracked to be smart, and so in that we kind of had this exclusivity, but at the same time we were still the twins. There was still no singular identity. There was no Shirlette and Charlotte, and that really didn't come honestly till we left home to go to school. We dressed alike till we were 18 years old, like literally exact same clothes until we were 18. And it was more, you know, I reflect on that often in terms of trying to figure out why that was an option for my mom. And I think it was because it was her way of teaching us equality, that no one person deserves more or less than the other. You know, sometimes I wish she would have taught it, you know, by at least letting us choose different colors.
That's right. Turn the hat around.
Exactly.
Somebody can turn it around. Well, that, you're in an interesting situation, though, around all of these people, a kind of community identity, a twin sister, and yet being singled out in the school system as these kids tracked in the gifted and talented. What were you making of all that? Was that confusing for you?
It was confusing, but it was clear. You know, I think we were very aware of the fact that we were two of three in terms of the number of black kids that actually had access. I mean, we got to do really cool stuff that I oftentimes felt like, wow, the kids in the slower, quote unquote, slower classes should be allowed to go out to cemeteries and like walk around and explore and, like, wow, this is just really is what a holistic learning experience is about. Yet it was preserved for, like, an exclusive bunch. And it made it difficult to get along with other black kids at times, you know, because they were as much aware of it as we were. But fortunately, we, you know, even at an early age, I think we had the ability to move between different communities and sects within community. And, you know, because we played sports and we also enjoyed academics and learning, and we also were creative. So we just had that ability to move between different communities, which was kind of our saving grace in a lot of ways.
How about the people taking care of you, your mother and your aunts? Were they able to deal with those distinctions? Now there's somebody who needs a kind, different kind of nurturing.
That's a good question. I think they learned to deal with it. I think they were always proud of us and always saw us as inquisitive and always encouraged that. But I don't think they initially knew how to deal with it because it's just simply not what they came from. They came from a really limited fold in terms of the opportunities that we were experiencing simply because we were academically gifted and because we were twins, which made us kind of like green thumbs. We had a little special magic about us that always made us, you know,
he's
special.
Your mother has since, though, I understand she still has the first book you ever wrote.
She does.
Right?
I was talking to her this morning, and she actually mentioned Paula the Pig, which is the title of the first book.
But how old were you when you wrote that?
It's like first grade, Miss Dupree's class.
Did she say why she kept that?
When we were talking this morning, she mentioned that she wanted to give it to my niece. And, but she decided against it because she felt like, you know, she wanted to keep it for posterity. But I think she, you know, was impressed by it because I did all the illustrations and, you know, parents always kind of anticipate that you will, maybe they see something you don't before, you know, and my mom always had that ability to kind of notice things as having some relevance. And she's, on top of that, she's a bit of a pack rat. She keeps she's got a room full of a lot of our stuff.
It'd be interesting to explore that, though, that mystery of how people in that environment, so much to take care of, so many details,
mm-hmm.
And yet the subtle cues that you can give that it would take a long time to look back and say, you know what, that was something special there. You can't see it for all. And the book itself, I mean, I believe it's about a pig who couldn't find a wig.
Yeah, it's like Paula the pig lost her wig and she had a date. She couldn't go on the date because, of course, she didn't have a wig.
Lost the wig.
I mean, how can you go on your pig date without your wig?
Talk more about how you knew so much about pigs, your life in the fields, and afterward, as I'm talking today with Sherlette Ammons, a singer, a songwriter, and a poet. Her latest EP is called And Lovers Like. We'll talk more about that and much, much more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour is artist Sherlette Ammons. She is the author of two collections of poetry, including Stumphole Anthology of Backwoods Blood, and that was published in 2002. Like all of our guests on the State of Things, you worked in the tobacco fields of North Carolina.
It's
one of the prerequisites. But you really did.
I really did.
Tell us about that.
It was like amongst my first jobs. And it's kind of a prerequisite to growing up in rural North Carolina, I think, particularly. This is, I guess, the 80s, roughly. But, all my family worked in the fields. And then, you know, kind of it was handed down to my generation. So myself and my sister and my cousins worked in the fields. And very genderized work. The boys and the men cropped tobacco. And the women worked on the trucks looping tobacco. And so... that was kind of like a something you notice really quickly. So myself and my sister were amongst the younger ones out there learning how to loop tobacco off the back of a truck that a tractor would drive up and park. And it was beautifully arranged. It was very organized so that the women could easily grab hold of it and hand it to other women who were like situated behind you.
And looping is what?
Looping is taking a grip full of the tobacco and handing it to the women that are situated behind you so they could take some string and loop it onto a stick. And then the stick would be hung, after the stick was full of tobacco, some men would come and they would go hang it in the barn to dry. So I don't even know if that process still takes place. I don't know if machines have replaced that or whatever, but that was one of our first jobs. My very, very first job that I remember was picking pecans, which... we were kind of hoodwinked into doing because we were just out in this beautifully open space of lined with pecan trees, and it was fun to be out there picking pecans. But we sold them by the bushel and made like $60, and we thought we were rich. So
yeah, is that hard work?
It's hard work. Yeah. It's hard work.
You have since looked back and reflected on that work, and I wonder how your ideas about it. I mean, it was just what you were doing at the time.
Yeah, at the time it was kind of what you knew you had to do. Yeah. Like you really didn't have much of a choice, particularly with the tobacco field stuff. Just waking up crack of dawn on a Saturday morning when you know intrinsically that other kids are probably watching cartoons or something. But, you know, it was definitely difficult work even as a kid who physically had the stamina to do it, but I actually think it completely informed my work ethic, even in terms of the literary and intellectual, quote unquote intellectual work, the non-manual work that I do now.
How so?
I think it taught me to leave it all out there, you know. I think it taught me that it taught me rhythm, definitely. I learned a lot about rhythm and picking a pace and sticking to it.
Both and the also, pace of the work. How about the stories? Because I know you've collected oral histories too, and I wonder if the whole storytelling part of that, being together with women, doing the work, in any way informs your work now.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no way it can't. I don't really recall being in that setting, particular setting, and hearing stories. But what I do recall is, like, the time after, like, after the day's work is done, everybody goes home, takes a foot tub bath, sits on the porch, and just kind of decompresses. And that's when the stories come out. And that's when you actually have time to congratulate yourself for a day's work well done. And actually, I still have a genuine affinity for and appreciation for manual labor. And I think it's tough to not place manual labor on a particular pedestal that,
right,
that downplays intellectual labor for a person who comes from a highly manual background. I think somehow it's easy to privilege manual labor in a way that does not allow yourself at times, if you don't constantly work on it, to be a thinking person and consider that work.
So you can come from a background where this kind of thing is denigrated. It's dismissed that,
right,
oh, they're just too smart for their own good or something like that.
Right.
Did you ever have that feeling when you began to pursue your career?
I had it more when I went to college.
Yeah. You went to NC State.
Right. And I really had some tussles with the whole idea of feeling disconnected from where I came from, because I wanted to be smart and I wanted to be intellectual and I wanted to explore that side of myself, and I didn't want dirt under my nails. But it wasn't in like a sadity kind of way. It was more like I understood the value of preservation in another way. Just like, you know, my grandma knew that canning things was important. I knew that preserving these stories was important.
Yeah, but part of you had to know that the way you're going about this is not going to get you any respect back from where you're from, or not much.
Right, or that I was going to have to work for the respect, because I knew what work was at that point. And I knew that nothing necessarily came easy. And I knew I would have to work to convince my folks that this was necessary. And actually, to their benefit, I was a bit surprised at how much they met me halfway on that, in terms of their giving and in terms of their wanting me to preserve these stories and pursue the idea of being a poet.
Yeah. When did that idea occur to you? Was it in college?
It occurred early on. It occurred, like I said, we grew up just mad creative as kids. But probably high school, I wrote a poem for valedictorian, and she read it at the graduation. And then in college, I started to actually meet like minds and go to poetry readings. And it was during the whole era of spoken word kind of resurging amongst hip-hop black kids who were like of this quote-unquote conscious hip-hop vein.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found like minds in that respect, and not only started writing, but started writing with the purpose of keeping it and sharing it. And that was pretty formative.
When you got to college, NC State, did you feel comfortable? Did you feel like you fit in?
I felt overwhelmed. Going from a graduating class of 56 people to a community of 20,000 was a bit, you know, shocking. But I had twin there, which helped. So we had that twin thing that we had cultivated for 18 years with us. But it was definitely a shock. And I don't know how much I really worked to belong maybe it's from being Southern or being rural, just an adamant observer. Just was like, saw so many different niches and people that I was like, oh, I wonder what it's like to be over here or over there. Similar to like when we were placed in, it's similar to where we were from, where we had to operate in all these different environments in order to belong in any of them. So
you had a little bit of practice because of all that sort of GT.
Absolutely.
Misplace and replacing yourself.
Exactly.
Back into the community. Did you? So you came to a political consciousness, it seems, in high school, if you're doing that kind of poetry. What about your consciousness about your sexuality as a gay woman?
I think that became more clear in college. I was very much closeted, but at the same time very aware of what was going on in my body in terms of desire and kind of sexual, feeling marginalized just by my own thoughts and desires. So I went out to California for a little while just to get away and kind of really consider how to live in my skin. And that's actually where I got most comfortable with coming back and saying to my mom, like, Mom, actually the way I framed it was, so, Mom, I think I'm as much likely to come home with a woman as I am a man. She's like, okay, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. But just trying to find the language to say, I think I know something about myself that I now need to share with you in order to feel comfortable with sharing it with the rest of the world.
Actually, I heard you tell a funny story about that. Part of the reason you said that before the trip.
Oh, yeah.
You had a reason for that.
Yeah, it's because I didn't want my folks to think California made me gay.
I see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you read a poem for us now?
I'll be glad to. This is from Matching Skin. It's called Playing Woman. Reduced from all capital letters, I find myself in the midst of living smaller than secluded, tinier than four writing walls. I guess this is a good beginning. I watch the mirror, believing Baldwin, a better woman than I, to confess that reflections have been known to lie, but I consider myself facing the truth, naked. If I could document all the women I have played, would I know which to deem accountable for this mural of mistakes? If I forget to leave an apology, will she sincerely accept the blame? If I find myself alone like a wrinkling Zora, coughing up everything but the memory, will I embrace old age? If I cannot absolve all the lovers who showered me with uncertainty, how will I keep my own taste buds from souring? A black girl playing woman is destined to be somebody's mama, paranoid and waiting, calculating every bruise, accepting each desperate collect call, beaming a scrapbook of basketball trophies, covering peeling panel with white Jesuses.
On the state of things today, Charlotte Ammons reading her poem Playing Woman from her collection Matching Skin. Talked about going out to California, and part of that was the quest to meet June Jordan.
Yes,
it
was.
Tell us about what was going on in your mind and what you thought was going to happen.
Well, I was at a point where I was really I started to create relationships through writing with particularly black women writers, particularly black women writers who were queer, and June Jordan just captivated me. I read Living Room, one of her collections, and just was inherently moved. And I started doing research and heard about her Poetry for the People's class that she taught at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And I was in Bakersfield, California, and part of the point of going to Bakersfield was just to get out west. And then I figure if I got to Bakersfield at least, which is in the middle of nowhere in Southern California, I could easily make a trek up to Berkeley. So I did. I took the train from Charlotte to Palm Springs, California, and then settled in at Bakersfield College out there. And maybe 2 weeks after I got settled in, made my way up to see Miss June. And when I went to sit in on the class, I was waiting outside for her to arrive, and the class was starting to congregate. She came up, and we had some light email conversations, and she said, well, wait here, and I have to go get permission from the class for you to sit in, which I thought was profound. And I was like, that's how it should be. This is a learning moment. Like, this is a real democratic process at work. And I was just moved by what I experienced, and then went back to her office and just had a really wonderful conversation with her, and that I still hold dear. And I guess maybe a couple years after that, she died.
Mm. What did she? Do you remember anything? What did she say to you? Is there anything in particular that stands out from that conversation?
She asked me what I wanted to do, but it was in a way that was kind of a call to action. She encouraged me to get focused, And I asked her, you know, a lot of questions about the choices she made. And I was always impressed. She was really one of the first people who gave me a global perspective, gave me a larger, expanded view of the South, not just the South the way I knew it, but the global South, and helped me put my own experience into a larger context.
When did you decide to pursue music?
Oh, boy. Probably music came later, the actual pursuit of it. I always had an affinity and a special place for it. Always had, you know, particular rhythm in my writing, but I guess music didn't come until like my mid-20s or so.
You played bass?
I got a bass from my uncle, my dad's brother, that he was not using, which I just found to be a travesty. And I just wanted to, I just really had this desire to learn something, and he happened to have a bass. And it was a red Peavey bass, candy apple red, and he gave me the bass and the amp, and I just completely fell in love with it. And every free moment I was trying to, you know, learn the bass line to a song or, you know, kind of in a really stripped down kind of way.
And now, you knew your dad growing up, but you said your relationship got much closer when you became an adult.
Absolutely. When I moved to Raleigh, we became closer. He was always around in that he would come around for holidays and, you know, kind of that typical missing dad story. He'd come around and buy me and twin clothes that were a little bit too big, but it was always the effort, you know. But he didn't live with us, and my folks were never married, but he was around in the sense that I always knew my grandma on his side, and always knew my uncles and aunts, on his siblings, and my cousins on that side of the family as well. So,
and you wrote a poem inspired by him. Will you read it for us?
I spent a lot of time right when he was sick and right after he died writing about him and my memories of our relationship. So this is called June's Blues. That's my pop's name, June. June's Blues. There's a black blues man with a dust-covered axe. For his daughter, he worked overtime with bosses on his back. Daughter bore her father's features. Some folk called her copycat. 'Cause the daughter, like her papa, took a wife. Yes, the daughter took to chopping, took a wife. Took the black blues man his mannish daughter for a son. Taught her how to push a mower just to tease them out some coins. Then one day, while she was toiling against both circumstance and son, family name became her carriage. Papa's work down here was done. Yes, the father's days of earthly work were done. So the black blues man chose to hasten to his throne, his body dressed for Galilee as the cancer honeycombed. Congregations speak of heaven, but however kingdom come, hope it don't got toil or bosses, just a place for axe and moan. Yes, a blues man needs a heaven, hostess moans.
Charlotte Ammons reading her poem June's Blues, written for her father, part of her the collection Matching Skin. How did he, when you came out to him, was he supportive? How did that go?
I never officially came out to my pops. My partner and I were living together in Durham, and he was always around. We had this really interesting relationship. I always thought he thought that I was his son in many respects, or he always treated me like a very stereotypically boy in that, you know, we'd look under hoods of cars together, neither of us knowing what we're looking at. he'd come out and help me, like, try to build a garden, and always had these really kind of tough conversations, like tough in a very masculinized kind of way. And he was very aware. I think it was the unspoken truth.
There are ways, aren't there, you know, you talk about coming from country church folk, conservative, not necessarily going to easily accept your sexuality. There are ways, though, that folks manage this kind of thing. They're much more subtle than meets the eye.
Absolutely. And I think that subtlety needs to be applauded and recognized. I think the only time it's detrimental is if it keeps you from being who you are. And in the case of my pops, I never felt like our subtlety kept him from knowing me.
Did he support your artistic pursuits?
Oh, he was so proud. I bought a bass guitar. He bought a bass guitar. But he was a cat who always had a collection of guitars that he never really learned to play, but he always had a collection of left-handed guitars, yeah. Really nice guitars. But he was always just really proud, really proud. And then I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to kind of build that relationship.
Talking with Sherlette Ammons today on The State of Things, musician and poet. More of our conversation and her music just ahead on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We're talking this hour with Sherlette Ammons. She's a writer and a musician based in Durham. Her most recent book of poetry is called Matching Skin. And this year she has collaborated with the Chapel Hill rock band The Dynamite Brothers on an EP called And Lovers Like. Here's a sample.
Yeah. I've been meaning to get back. The challenges, distractions, issues to get past. Past the madness, then the math after. Music is postponed. Muted my ringtone. Just needed to get gone. Just needed to vanish. Like EDPF in the lines of a ballad. You know something about that. That's why we connect like borders to continents. Your voice ricochets like I press playback. Time is magic. Free and defiant. Salute to the rest.
Sherlette Ammons, The Dynamite Brothers, featuring vocalist Jocelyn Ellis. Collaboration has really been a hallmark of your career. You have worked with a lot of groups. Now The Dynamite Brothers. How did you get connected with them?
The Dynamite Brothers guitarist, Mitch Rothrock, used to sub for Mosadi, my band, occasionally. And I was already a fan of The Dynamite Brothers. I heard them play back in early 2000s at the Old Kings in Raleigh Kings Barcade. Mm-hmm. And I was just highly impressed with what they do, the psychedelic rock meets funk thing that they do, and it's, they just go so hard, and it's genuinely funky. So the Dynamite Brothers were working on their most recent album called Again, and as they were working, Mitch sent me some like instrumentals and was like, hey, you want to just kind of try to mess around with these, see if you have any ideas come from them? And so I did. I started, you know, just kind of fiddling with stuff and had some ideas, kind of backburned it. Other things took precedent. Then their album came out, and I noticed that they had used some of those same instrumentals that Mitch had sent me. So then I started sending Mitch my ideas, like, hey, yeah, I just remembered. I just heard your album. It's really dope. And here's some of the things I was doing with some of those songs. And actually had you know, written more songs that I had even realized from the Dynamite Brothers' music. And we decided, hey, why don't we just make a project out of this? So a lot of the songs on And Lovers Like are born out of instrumentals from the Dynamite Brothers Again album. So if you purchase the Again album and then purchase And Lovers Like, you can hear two different takes on a lot of some of the same music.
What about in terms of vocals? Does it inspire you in different ways to work with different kinds of music?
Absolutely. I think that's the beauty of collaborating. A lot of the songs I kind of demoed on my computer, just me and GarageBand and some headphones late night, and put ideas down, and then kind of had other vocalists in mind. So I came up with ideas and did like the best I could at recording demos, and then kind of shipped them off to different people. Said, "Hey, could you make this sound good, like it's supposed to?" So that's Ketchup is actually an original tune that the Dynamite Brothers had yet to record, and so I kind of fleshed out an idea for a chorus and some verses, but realized that I couldn't do them justice. Mm-hmm. So I called up Jocelyn, who Jocelyn Ellis lives in Charlotte, but she's from Durham. Beautiful young vocalist, very talented, and she was down to do it. Added her own flavor to it and made a really cool song. And then we got Pierce Freeland to jump on it as well.
Is there something unique you think about North Carolina? This sort of thing seems to go on at a level that I'm not sure happens other places.
Yeah, I'm not sure it happens other places either. I mean, really, the variety of musicians that we have access to,
right.
And the number of folks I was able to ask to participate on this project from various genres is pretty amazing, you know, when I look back at it.
Yeah.
And I mean, Daniel Hart, who plays violinist, plays in a band called Physics of Meaning, and also plays with Saint Vincent, who's a national touring artist. And then Justin Robinson, who used to play with the Chocolate Drops, who now has his own thing, Justin Robinson and the Marionettes, and who has that old time sound. Then Shauna Tucker, who's got her own chamber soul kind of sound. And then the Dynamite Brothers, who have this thing. And then Pierce, who's hip hop, and Yazra, who's soul and rock. It's just pretty amazing. And they're all right here.
We talked about Justin, formerly of the Chocolate Drops. You collaborated on a tune called "Kissin' and Cussin'."
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. We're going to hear some of that, but tell us about that.
"Kissin' and Cussin'" is a song Justin wrote originally that appeared on the Drops Grammy Award winning album called "Genuine Negro Jig." Me and Justin are friends, and he came to the house one time, and we were just kind of fiddling through some of his demos on his little iPod or whatever. And he played that in a very skeletal version of "Kissin' and Cussin'." And I was like, man, that's dope. It's really haunting. The message is so visual. It's kind of like a soundtrack or something.
Yeah.
Or just a short film, except it's a song. And I was like, I'd love if you let me write to that. So I wrote one verse, and we performed that quite a bit when I would sit in with Justin and the Marionettes. He was so gracious to let us do a Sherlett and the Dynamite Brothers version where we added a second verse that I wrote, and then threw some background vocals from Adrian Duke up there, and this really haunting violin solo from Daniel Hart at the end.
Let's hear a little bit of that, "Kissin' and Cussin'."
Your kiss is fist violent, each pound arousing, each lick inherited is handed down. And I'm mounting horseshoes and loose and roosters, praying for luck change, my infidel and abuser. My rebel rouser, food provider, cigarette lighter, your liquor hits quicker like lightning. Mine is quieter like slow horizons are shushing mine. Your business, cause every shut eye ain't dog dead or sleeping. She's seasoned with love stains and blood pains, breed dreams about bruised deep but sweeter days. In a prayer I ain't lifted a number I ain't played, so I'll kiss and cuss till I'm carried away.
Tell me, pretty baby, do you think you're too sweet to die?
Tell me,
pretty baby, do you think you're too sweet to die? We cuss and we kiss and we carry on.
Until the break of dawn.
I'm too big, too big,
instead of all this kissing and cussing.
Tell me, pretty baby, do you think you're too sweet to
die? There's a little bit of kissing and cussing. Charlotte Ammons, the Dynamite Brothers. You know, there's a song now inspired by essentially a roots musician, right? I mean, if you think about Justin Robinson and the Chocolate Drops, a guy whose heart is there much of the time. Then you've got an indie blues rock band,
right.
and all of your work as a poet and your Mosadi music, I guess, could be classified as hip hop.
Right.
All of that stuff rolling through that music.
Yeah, that's kind of the plan. That's the vision, at least, to kind of blur those lines so folks get less caught up in, well, what am I listening to? Right. What is this? And just more enjoy the music and enjoy the story. Enjoy the songwriting, enjoy the effort, enjoy all the multiplicity of voices and the undulation of it all. Enjoy the composition, and just that's the only thing you should be concerned with. It actually makes for a better listening experience, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
When you let all that stuff go.
What is it when you're composing a piece like that? I guess inspired certainly by hearing other people's stuff. But what's happening to you when? You're not. I'm just trying to get at the creative process a little bit. If little hooks or riffs pass through your head,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of capture them when they happen?
Yeah, I think you kind of, at least I have to. Mm. My memory is not that great, so I really have to capture in the moment. And just kind of, you know, run them over and over and over. And usually a riff leads to another riff. One word or one idea leads to another idea. And before you know it, you have this complete thought. And I've really been interested, maybe it's the whole getting older thing,
mm-hmm.
in creating like thematic work, even in a collaborative process that has a zillion people involved. The ultimate project be a thematic work that kind of works collectively as one body.
Do you hear a theme in, if you look back at your body of work, does a theme emerge for you?
I'm working towards it. That's the beauty, and that's actually like the dragon I chase ultimately, because, you know, it feels incomplete. I feel like I have much more work to do, but I actually feel like this project, this particular project, is the best example I have so far of a project being collaborative and thematic in and of itself. That's one thing I learned from Nikki Finney, who was a great inspiration and mentor. But I tried to achieve it somewhat with the last project, with the Matching Skin and John Anonymous project, but feel closer to it with this.
You've also collaborated with Yazra on a song called Tomorrow Never Comes. I want to hear a little bit of that as well.
Yeah.
Tomorrow Never Comes, Yazira and my guest, Sherlette Emmons. Now, there's someone else who works right from the heart, the soul, and the mind, yeah, always together when she's on stage.
Oh, yeah. Love Yazira. I remember when she was on here, actually, with Chris Berner. Mm-hmm. And there's another relationship. Chris also plays with Mosadi. And it was just, she always brings so much soul and passion and all I have to say is, can you do your thing to this, please? And she does it, yeah, and it just comes off amazingly every time.
What's next for you? What's next for the band, for Mosadi?
Mosadi's kind of on hiatus right now, and fortunately it's because we're all fairly busy. So right now Mosadi's kind of taking a break and thinking about revamping that a little bit. So I'll keep my hold my tongue on that till I have more details.
How about your writing?
Next is, I kind of do this, I don't know, I don't feel necessarily intentional, but I produce a work every couple years. So I'm feeling poetry, I feel like revisiting poetry is about to be upon me a little bit.
Well, when you do, will you revisit us?
Oh, my pleasure.
Sherlette, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Frank. Appreciate it, as always.
Sherlette Emmons, writer and musician, lives in Durham. Her latest project is a collaboration with the Dynamite Brothers called And Lovers Like. For more information about the EP, you can go to facebook.com/Sherlette and the Dynamite Brothers. You can catch them in concert in September at the Hopscotch Festival in Raleigh. Thanks for listening. This is The State of Things. You can find us on Facebook and at stateofthings.org on the web. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados with help from Isaac Davey Aronson. Robin Copley is the technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.